appointment. Where do we get this S I S?
That's
the best. Whereabouts is that?
I just have 12.
12:55.
Well, it must have gone 75, right?
No, I thought it was 63 or something.
It was passed by the first Republican legislature. It was passed by the people who threw out the Democrats.
I don't care if it's in law or not, it's bad law.
Okay, all those in favor, Mr. Dankwitz, motion, raise your right hand. All those opposed, can you vote for the side?
For the record, that was Dankwitz, let me tell him.
The chair will recognize the official record, which is no votes. Okay. We're on page 3 then.
Well, I just wanted to announce that I counted up a couple minutes ago, and the first 2 pages we deleted 10 minutes.
That's
great. We deleted 6 pages. That's for you.
We deleted 20 from 661.
You are the chair.
This will be under 100 pages.
They
have
no
community. We have to throw out a multiplication of
the
chart.
The last line that subsection B, or impose any other civil penalty, so can that be construed as nothing in this section deprives the court of any authority to impose any other civil penalty? Could that be construed, or could it be argued down the pike that it would be in lieu of anything we set up in this chapter?
I think that, sure, that it wouldn't be, but I don't think it could. In the first line of B, it's simply saying nothing in this section applies A court. Because I don't think you can have the court giving a civil penalty in a criminal case.
Oh, we do it
all the time.
Sure, they take forfeitures. Sure, forfeitures.
Well, I'm not sure if forfeiture is civil. Well, I see. I'm not sure that's correct.
Must go on a fishing game violation and file a civil action against him before his airplane, and actually against the airplane.
Okay, fine, but it's a civil action. So it's not as part of the criminal case.
No.
Okay, so why don't we just say nothing in the court applies A court? I mean, B court, you know what I'm saying?
That's fine.
Wait a minute, now that's a legal distinction of iron and whatever you're talking about. What is that?
Well, I'm afraid what it says, your concern is that you have an assault and battery case. We're saying perhaps the court, as part of the assault and battery case, can say, I'm also by damages of $50,000. I know it's ridiculous, you know, but the way it's drafted, it says nothing in the section of the court of authority conferred by law to create forfeiture or impose any other civil penalty. Now, I'm not sure whether the authority conferred by law modifies the civil penalty.
Okay, you're missing my point, Barry. You're missing my point, and maybe it's simplistic. I'm asking, is it arguable that a court can impose any other civil penalty as opposed to a presumptive sentence?
No.
Well, that's what it says.
No. I don't think it does. What it means is they could apply it in addition. You see, it's not an authorized sentence.
This just says that because they give you a presumptive sentence that you can't argue, hey, you can't find me because I've been presumptive.
No, don't say that. Say forfeiture.
Yeah. That's the argument that's going to come up.
No, it says nothing in this deprives the court of any other authority. In other words, if I get sentenced presumptively and they want to forfeit my airplane, then I can't go in and argue you can't forfeit my airplane because you put me in
this
jail.
Is from existing law, by the way. I mean, this is not something that was dreamt up. Let me just try to find it.
You can look in the drug statutes.
Mr. Chairman, I understand Mr. Wilde's problem. I think we could probably write it better, and we maybe we could say in addition to. Maybe we should just say that nothing in addition to the penalties authorized under this chapter, the court is not deprived of its authority to.
This is merely a disclaimer.
We don't even need it.
Yeah.
We're gonna get right down to it.
It's a disclaimer.
But you don't maybe not want. You may not want to strike because it is an existing law. You do have that provision in existing law. But we could, it's a research question.
I don't think it has to be
law.
Where?
Oh, I'll get you.
I mean, not especially in like a drug statute.
No, it's Title 11 or 12.
Oh, I didn't know that.
you could continue.
Well, that deleting it, that isn't some of your problem, is it? Or do you know?
No, I honestly don't know.
It seems to say that the court can do anything it wants in lieu of what we're saying it's supposed to do.
I can't read it that way, Bill. I really honestly can't. I hear you saying that, and I read it, and it seems to mean the opposite of what you're saying.
Mr. Chairman, I think you can correct it by just saying, I'm not sure the exact, in addition to the penalties authorized by this chapter, the sentences authorized through this chapter, the court may...
When authorized by law.
Well, you do that at the end. The court may order a decree of forfeiture of your property, when authorized by law.
Yeah, my message isn't getting through.
What is your message?
I've said it four different ways.
If your message that they can use this to throw out all the presumptive terms and give a guy a civil penalty.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And what I'm saying is...
Why would you say in addition to? Why don't you say the court may not in lieu of, or, whatever language is right.
Because Section A addresses sentencing for criminal offenses.
I just don't see the statute. Where's the statute book?
Right here.
Oh,
no, I don't know where it is. I've got my text.
Well, I need my 12 months. Can we seriously? Can we just hold off on this? I mean, I haven't found existing law yet. We sit down with it. I know what the intent is. The intent also is to say that just because you have a penalty here, a criminal penalty, doesn't mean you can't go
civil.
Okay, that may be the intent. It could also be read the other way.
I agree. I don't agree on that. But to ensure that it isn't, let us.
I understand Miles' problem at that point.
Miles' problem.
Okay.
Miles' problem.
All right, after an hour and 10 minutes, we made it past two pages. Moving on. So we're doing good work here. All right, page 3. Sentencing procedures. Now, where is all this from?
Sentencing procedures is...
661,
maybe? No, that's your rewrite, isn't it? Yeah. Sentencing procedures
is... basically from 661, which I tried to make a lot shorter.
Yeah.
By deleting a lot of what I consider to be unnecessary language.
Let's hear it, Brian.
Okay.
There's
just a cut and paste on that.
Yeah, we'll see that moment. Okay.
Yeah,
we'll see
that moment. That's just corporate.
Sure, I would agree that it is unnecessary.
Especially to this.
Oh, especially to that. Life's are complicated.
Which is what the judge has to go through every time he sentences somebody. That's what condition discretion is all about.
No, he doesn't go through the classes, in fact, because he doesn't have any.
Well, he has
eight
classes over it, but he does go
through it. What about section, subsection F?
Straight out of 661.
Also straight out of...
and also existing law.
Existing law.
Which means that you can, like, if the defendant is supposed to pay a fine and he doesn't, and he's got a car, I guess it means you can go against the car.
It also means restitution. I think it's a good idea to do it in restitution. I'm not sure if restitution is current law applies to restitution, but what I think this does is gives the victim an opportunity to file a lien against the accused or the convicted person's some of his property in order to guarantee restitution. I think that's a great idea because you're running into all the time in the criminal courts where the guy can't make pay. He won't pay the fine. He doesn't pay restitution. They got to drag him in and threaten to throw him in jail and seize his property. And if you move it into the civil area a little bit more where they can just slap a lien on the guy's car, on his house, on his boat, or whatever it is. Take it that way. It sort of gets a little bit instant negative reinforcement on the guy.
It's also based on existing law.
No, it isn't.
Okay.
It's purely unconscious.
Does anybody have any questions on page 3?
No. Is this in 1 and 2 that there's something negative? Is that consistent with present law?
That's the existing statute, which was just recently passed, too.
That
was set back in 1925.
Mr. Chairman,
76.
that watch very quickly.
Mrs. Brennan.
In reading the very first sentence before the colon there, I became confused. I would like to amend it to move the phrase as a part of the record from the third line into the second line after prepare, so that it would be the court shall prepare as a part of the record of sentencing report, which includes the following. Because it looks as though the court shall prepare a sentencing report as a part of the record, which, and the record would include the following.
You don't even need it part of the record.
I don't even think you need the whole thing. I mean, they're going to have, he's got, the judge always does that.
Yeah, that's just a recent statute.
It's all a matter of, that's where the, you know, the attorneys come in.
Wait a minute, what should it read?
I think Mrs. A suggestion was not fine.
So it read, it would read on the second line, the court shall prepare as a part of the record of the sentencing report, which includes the following.
Is there any objection to that amendment? Not Mrs. Stoughton. Any more?
Okay. Chairman, I don't think subsection 1 is necessary. Is that a matter of present law?
Yes.
I mean, because they do tape everything, so that's a verbatim record.
That's existing law. I don't like it.
Yeah.
But I...
What you're changing.
Well, what's the matter with it?
It just kind of sounds kind of... officious to me.
How do you mean?
They always take procedures.
Of course, they didn't always use to.
Yeah.
And they don't federal court, so maybe it's a good idea.
Maybe it's a good idea.
Yeah. You know what they do in military courts? You see this guy's big mask. It looks like a gas mask he puts over his face, and he mouths into this thing the exact words that every speaker is speaking. The last trial I had in military court, this guy had been doing it for 15 years, sitting there.
Okay, yeah. Is there any other changes on page 3?
One change that you might want to know about that I made, a lot of times in existing law in 661, they would use the terms a clear and concise statement.
There is a safe statement.
Ambiguous sentence.
And I'm
confused.
Maybe confused. What did you use?
I just put a clear statement. I don't know. Maybe you could just say a statement. A clear and concise.
Well, sometimes they don't make a clear statement.
Yeah.
You know, and that a lot of that depends on the effectiveness of the attorneys that force them into making a clear statement.
Hold on.
Force them into making findings.
Yeah. Well, I just thought clear and concise both were not necessary modifiers, and clear would be adequate.
I agree with you, Anne. I'm of the opinion that if you want to be clear, you must be concise.
This substantially expands upon existing law because the records are not prepared in the case of misdemeanors.
This would require
required in the case of misdemeanors.
Yeah, I don't know why the commission did it. I know the commission said 180 days, and 180 days was tied into something, and Doug and I know discussed it once. But existing law is limited just to felonies, and maybe we don't want to expand it to misdemeanors.
Well, if you have a misdemeanor sentence to a year.
The reason is, if you go up 180 days, and that's 180 days, you have a right to a sentence.
Yes, that's right. You have the right to a sentence if you're
the law. So you might as well get it,
that's right.
You know, if you're going to do it, do it. So that's going to protect the state more than it's ever going to protect the defense, because then the judge is going to jump through the hoops and cover himself on the record every time. Whereas you can get procedural appeals, basically. Because the guy didn't cover himself well enough on the record.
Yeah.
What this basically does is cleans up the Attorney's Act. It covers it for a bunch of incompetent prosecutors.
Well, let's hear it for
the Supreme Court.
The attorney should always be doing
state court law.
I can
get on the line. Okay.
Leadership issue, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, page 4 then.
Okay, designation of defense.
Designation.
There's something wrong with the MAC card. It does interchange the E's and I's when they're on their capital F. That's boilerplate somewhere.
Just one change. Section 5, I would say, for the purpose of sentencing, crimes are classified. That's what you have crimes there. And then
Section 5?
Yeah, Section 5, line 2, to change offenses to crimes. It's just technical. And I think you may want... the other thing is, well, it's a draft thing, we'll discuss it.
What's that, Greg?
Well, I was just going to say, we could keep it as offenses and then just have 7 say violations are not classified instead of a subsection B. You see what I mean? In other words, say offenses are classified, then 1 through 6, and then 7 becomes B. I think that's preferable, actually.
Except it's, you know, to me, it never made any sense to say offenses are classified, and then...
Just be shorter and sweeter to say an offense which is defined as a felony outside this title.
Yeah.
Yes.
An
offense defined
which is defined as a felony outside this title, which is defined outside this title as a felony.
Okay. I'll move that as an amendment.
Similarly, the next section.
Okay, I move the same language in both section 4A and 4B.
Chairman, let us be clear. We read an offense which is defined outside this title as a felony without which specification of the Constitution.
Is that correct now?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then subsection B2 is just an identity change, I believe. For Mr.
Is there any objection to that amendment?
I think we could cut out the word either, and it would read better too. Outside this title, as a felony without specification of the classification or of the penalty. I had trouble reading that.
I'm not responsible for this English.
Neither am I.
What do you want to cut out now?
Just the word either on line 5.
There's nothing in this.
So it would read outside this title as a felony without specification of the classification or of the penalty.
In both of them?
Yeah.
Okay, is there any objection to deleting either? There's no objection. Amend this down. Is there any other changes on page 4?
Yeah, and just to, I would go back now in section 5, line 2, go back to what originally said offenses, and then add 7 and just say violations, period. Offenses are classified in the following categories, 1 through 7, 7 being violations, knock out B. This is Pat Conhady's suggestion.
It's the first time that I had my English people do
that. Is there any question on that?
I prefer the way it is now, but maybe Pat can just...
Well, aren't you essentially saying, like, by putting it, violations are not classified, aren't you essentially classifying?
It was a violation of crime, that's...
Well, no, we're going back to offenses.
Categories.
Yeah.
When you say offenses are classified, that doesn't have any meaning.
Well, they're classified as offenses.
So something's classified.
They're classified
what,
as categories.
One thing we want to be sure of is that in this bill or someplace in 661, you say that a violation is not crime.
Oh, we have that in the definition of in the general provisions specifically.
Okay. I'll move the amendment.
You should strike A then.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Any objection to amendment change number 7 to violation? No objection to amendment.
Okay. I'll let Ann go for it on this one.
Okay. This looks excellent.
Ann, we wrote.
Well, I just took out a lot of language.
Yeah.
That I didn't think was
very
necessary. Do you want me to explain what I did, or just look at it? Did you like it?
Okay, this is just mainly redraft. Let's just let everybody look at it. There, one thing.
I think in this one, Ann and I got together and decided there was just commission people were enamored with precisely defining every element of everything they were ever concerned about with the issue. There was just a lot of redundancy, and I think that's the issue we're having with the science.
Well, what do we have, Mr. Chairman, over here in that sentence up on about the fourth line, that's not the idea.
Well,
it says line 9 on this. Where is it part of the present law? No defendant may be in prison solely because of
That's a
constitutional
question. There's a specific Supreme Court opinion on this, and that's the exact words.
In the U.S.
We need that.
No, Alaskan Constitution. It could be smelled in the Alaskan case.
What do you put in?
Well,
if that's just a fact.
Exactly. No, they have to look at the case.
Okay.
There's a specific Alaskan case.
Is there a federal case on it?
A federal provision on it?
Federal and Supreme Court case.
I can't answer that. I know there's a specific state.
Sure, there is, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Pretty basic.
A lot has developed ever since there are two people in jail.
That's what I'm saying. This constitution, I'll tell you more I hear about it, the less I knew about it. If the court wants to find me $10,000, I don't want to pay it, and I just say I'm broke.
No.
Solely.
Because I can't afford to pay the fine, they can't put me in jail.
No. Well, if you're going to sentence him, in the first place, when they sentence the guy, they're not going to sentence him to a $10,000 fine if they know he can't pay it. They're going to throw him in jail.
Well, if you don't,
said
if you don't
the
pay
guy,
they'll find you in contempt, won't they? If you have the money, then he said it's your
yeah.
Right, then they put you in jail. Under B. Or
under B. I'm telling you.
That's our next the subcommission's going to make
this. We may make him out of felon in the next chapter. Mr. Miles.
Are we down at
D?
Do you
want
the numbers for
fines?
If the default on a fine, do we have a maximum fine for default?
We can't fine them any more than they've originally been fined.
Well, I mean, let's say there's a judgment, and is there a maximum fine that can be imposed?
Well, that's what we got to decide to be.
For each case, or
are you asking whether you can impose a fine for failure to pay a fine?
No. Is there a maximum fine if somebody's found guilty of a crime?
Yes, and that's, you gotta fill in the numbers.
Yeah, we gotta fill in the numbers
of 17.
That's a policy decision. It hasn't been made by the committee yet. What the numbers should be.
Okay. And just arbitrarily, let's say that's $10,000. And then Section D says if the defendant defaults and the court finds that was an intentional default, term of imprisonment under this section may not exceed 1 day for each $50, or 6 months, whichever is shorter. What if there is a fine for a class A, B, or C felony of, let's say it's $10,000, and he's sentenced to pay the fine, and he doesn't pay the fine. So he can only go to jail for a maximum of 6 months.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a little bit of a slip up. I intended to put a blank in where every number was, and I just didn't there. This is what the commission, they went through a wild debate
the commission, on this. The commission decided this.
Yeah, they went through it, yeah. But they went through a wild debate on this and decided you shouldn't ever have anybody in jail longer than 6 months for failure to pay a fine.
Well, a fine is in lieu of going to the slammer, right?
Yeah, of course, the commission takes that lower fine.
But it may be.
Well, a court may decide to impose if you don't have presumptive sentencing on first offenders, you might have courts not imposing jail time on A, B, or C felonies instead of jail.
Or you
could
do it together. You could sentence him to jail plus
But you can also sentence a person to a fine and imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. It's, essentially fine. You never have a fine that's imposed to a final. I've never heard of that, and I don't think it'll ever will be done.
Impose a fine for murder, instead of maximum. Courts just don't do that.
Okay.
Why don't we just make it blank there?
What?
Right.
You mean
up to
$50?
Yeah, $50. $50 in 6 months for policy decisions that perhaps the committee should decide later.
I just
well, we would want to look how much for
what's a, is the Department of Law going to figure out what you can recommend?
For fines?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the Department of Law would recommend higher than $10,000 for A, B, and C,
and we would probably recommend $50,000 for ABC. Because as the police were particularly in favor of raising the possible fine, and particularly since you can't imprison a person solely for an inability to pay a fine, there might be a situation in a property crime where a person just makes a lot of money and you would want the court to have the ability to impose a fine higher than $10,000. We would probably be recommending $50,000 for class A.
Very well with the
10,000 for A, B, and C.
And I'd put it to the committee's question whether, instead of having a blanket figure for all felonies, that you distinguished between A, B's, and C felonies. I don't see why here we're saying all felonies should be treated identically. I could see perhaps saying even as high maybe as 100 for an A felony, 50 for B, and 25 for C, or something like that.
What kind of A felony?
Your C's are the $100,000 amount of gain. That's where you want the high level.
The C's are.
And you'll never want to impose $100,000 fine at all for an A felony, because
no, you wouldn't.
Yeah, person.
Here, crime. Here.
You might be probably right on that. Okay.
Barry, what were the other numbers? It was 10,000, what was A?
A was 1,000, I believe. B was 500. Violation was 300. Violation, you got to keep it, you know, at 300.
What other figures? Did you have other figures that you can recommend?
I think maybe we had $10,000 for class A misdemeanors.
Living on the
Not
all right, well, let's leave open the lines.
Questions. What does the court do if there's a financial gain crime that, let's say, is a C felony or something similar to a C felony, and the dude is loaded? I mean, he could pay the $50,000. Would the court throw the guy in the can, or would he find? Would the court find him? As it
both.
Well, let's say it's serious. It's probably equal to a C felony, where the guy went up and perpetrated some sort of extortion or whatever.
One of the games in the criminal justice process, when you get that situation, like they did with Liddy and these guys, they find them and sentence them to jail, and then. Parole board sits around and says, well, we're not going to parole you, boy, until you pay your fine. Uh-huh. So that's a way of keeping the guy in jail longer than, you know, his minimum time for parole, if the court imposes a substantially high fine. It happens a lot, actually.
But to get at Bill's concern, what I suggest you want to do it is 21 and 22, you see that when we're dealing with organizations, we can give a fine twice for pecuniary gain. Why not just have that applied to persons, too? I mean, why just organizations?
It's a very... Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it a very difficult thing to exact the amount of pecuniary?
Yeah, but if you could do it, then it's higher than the maximum fine. What the hell? You know, it's not.
Yeah. But I mean, you should still have your maximum fine high enough.
Let's go ahead and adjourn.
Are we going to show up at 7?
No.
Good morning.
I want to. Finish the rest of the sentencing tomorrow.
Well, I should be sent to
you. We're not. Wow.
Possibly addressing Bill, he's in
the You were probably involved in the conspiracy. You know what he did with
him? He gave you right back for
it. Well, see? Okay, page 4.
Criminal liability of an individual for organization conduct. This state. There were no questions, I believe, when we went over this. It simply states that just because you cause conduct in the name of an organization, it doesn't mean that you escape liability. Both the organization could be liable as well as the person himself. As basically just excluding that as an offense. Okay. The next thing we've got, I drafted up an amendment to this, the whole thing on justification. No one has it. I need enough for
the to replace the whole section?
Yeah.
Replace the whole chapter.
Yeah, I think one stash was left out, but I'll point it out to you.
No, okay. This goes, I hope, in part to the problems involving justifiable use of force.
Do you have a copy of this? You don't want to include the hand preparatory stuff with the area. And do you want a copy?
Yes.
Yes, that's on just the second TD2. That's on page on page 38. Yes, I have. Oh, and we also have a worksheet.
goes all the way up through page 12 for the patent?
Correct. There's one statute that's left out, and I'll point that out to you, but the majority probably is more than the paper than this stuff there. Let me explain. Do I have a worksheet? Let me first explain the amendment. Okay.
In very general terms.
There was a failing by these people that testified that the sections and justification were unclear because we did not make clear when we were talking about physical force, deadly force, non-deadly force. Certainly from the testimony that I heard, when you authorize deadly force under the code, people want to know about it. In other words, they don't want it crouched in terms of physical force and then have to turn to the back and see that physical force includes deadly physical force. So what I have done is I've basically divided the use of force into two components, the use of non-deadly force and the use of deadly force. Obviously, when you're saying you may use deadly force, it also includes the use of non-deadly force. Okay? Now, so I think it's clearer just in that regard, in terms of separation of deadly force from non-deadly force. Now, also during the testimony, a number of questions arose, and I tried to summarize those questions by the worksheet I just gave out. I think it would be helpful, as opposed to looking at the language first, to try to arrive at decisions regarding those eight questions I have on the worksheet, and then get into the language. The first question is, should non-deadly force include the threat to use deadly force so long as the person's intent is limited to creating apprehension that he will use deadly force? The best example is, and this was brought up during testimony, the police officer says, get in the back of the car, and the person doesn't move and he points the gun. Just get back into the car. And it was felt, at least by the testimony that we heard, that you should authorize, I'm sorry, that whenever we authorize non-deadly force, that should include the threat to use deadly force, so long as it's only a threat. And the amendment includes that concept. I think you need to first decide whether you want that. Now, under the bill... That's correct. That would be in the new language. Okay. Now, in the bill, we said in the bill that if you can't use deadly force, you can't threaten it. Okay? Now, the amendment changes it by saying that if you could use non-deadly force, you could threaten deadly force. For purposes of this discussion, I'd like your decision to be solely based on peace officers. In other words, a threat by a peace officer to use deadly force should not be considered deadly force. And then we could decide the other issues about whether it should apply to regular persons also. And I'm talking about peace officers in making an arrest. Or actually, I'm also talking about peace officers in self-defense also. So.
This is around page 10 here now.
Well, that just shows how I propose to deal with the threat. When you turn to page, I think if we deal with it, I'm not asking you about that language, I'm just asking you about that concept.
So, okay, the question is, even though a peace officer may not be able to use deadly force, he can threaten deadly force. In other words, he would not be able to shoot you for not getting off the street, but he could threaten you.
But then if you drew a gun, then another provision of the law would allow you to go to the level of deadly force.
In other words, you arrest the guy for the
front
guard.
Here's the reason why I think you can. You're dealing with, I'd like to deal with it because I think that peace officers are more trained in the use of deadly force. Whereas if you're dealing with two citizens, some guy, the person pulls out a gun and says, I'm going to blow your head off, and the other citizen takes it as being a real threat and then pulls out a gun himself. Now, you may not want to divide the issue. You may want to decide the purposes of this entire code. It should be. I just thought that the clearer case is when you're dealing with peace officers.
Okay.
I
think we should let police officers have latitude. And I don't know what I'm going to say. Do I allow Lisa that latitude?
Well, that's why I think Barry's separating the question.
Yeah.
Is the draw that distinction.
As he has a draft in the amendment, it's not the
amendment. That's correct, but I don't think you should concentrate on the amendment.
Okay. As opposed, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's just vote on these questions. And okay, the first question is then, is whether the first question is whether the peace officer, even though he cannot use deadly force, could threaten deadly force.
Yes.
Yeah. Any objection to that? Okay.
Okay, now the next issue, of course, is as applied to everyone else.
No. Okay. Is there any debate on that question? We're talking about whether a citizen should have the right, even in a situation where he cannot use deadly force, to threaten deadly force. Okay. And
if I hold my property and a guy comes up there and I don't like him, I pull my shotgun, tell him to get off my property, you're naked or whatever, but they make you tell me to get off my property. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly.
We're not, we wouldn't shoot a guy from the property, but if we can't threaten him, can't.
Well, that's not what you said. You said
okay.
You didn't like him. You didn't say you were
coming. That's the best example.
I think Ed's hit it on his. That's the most likely example. We did have testimony in Fairbanks on this. People said, look, even though we can't shoot the guy for trespassing, we want the ability to be able to pull out a gun, because what if it's your wife and there's five guys and they're all bigger than you and you want to have something to equalize
the truck driving into the
back. Right. Yeah. So that's one of the arguments on that side. Larry?
Well, I think that it's quite often the case that policemen aren't trained well enough to know the difference between whether they can go ahead and shoot somebody or they can't. And I submit that the citizen, you're prepared to know when to cross the threshold or not. And that we should prohibit the entering into the sequence of events that could lead to something that would affect that citizen a whole hell of a lot worse than if he kept it in his pocket.
Lisa?
Well, I wouldn't want to shoot
somebody. I think I agree with Larry, partly because maybe the training isn't good enough, but police have had training in these areas, and maybe they can use the weapons a little bit more responsibly or with a little more restraint than a lot of other citizens do. Also, the reason I voted for police to have that power is because police very often get into very bad situations where they need that power, and the citizens very rarely do.
Chairman, I don't agree. I think I agree with Ed and the witnesses we heard. Because if you're training or no training, if you're in a situation where nobody apparently armed, you might have your own suspicions that they wouldn't be legally justified or legally reasonable, perhaps. But two or three or four guys come up in a relatively isolated area, say way out here in the valley somewhere, and they're on somebody's property. And it's my property, it's my house, and I don't really like the way, you know, they're obviously setting up to do something. If I just walk out, I don't have any kind of a firearm, I say, leave this property or I will do something. Now, that's not very effective. I'm allowed to use, if we exclude the citizen, I'm only allowed to use physical force that is reasonably necessary to repel the attack without escalating. Even though I don't know whether every one of them may be carrying a concealed weapon. Under those circumstances, I think that whether or not we change it, in fact, in those situations, a guy's going to walk out with a shotgun. And if we don't change it, then he's going to be guilty of assault simply by having the gun and pointing it without firing it, even if most of the suspicions were right and he, in fact, repelled what otherwise would have been an invasion of his privacy or a crime against the person. His own person or a member of his family.
Chief Martin, you've obviously had a lot of involvement both ways.
I have a tendency to agree with him, but I think perhaps it might be very narrowly limited by going back over to page 4 on justification of use of force in defense of property. You know, very narrowly limited to your property type of situation, and say that the person may use non-deadly force or threaten to use deadly force. You make it very specific that they can threaten to use it here in these situations. And then you come down over here, if it escalates, you know, for some reason they pull a gun on them or take after him with a tire iron or something like that, then of course they have the right to protect themselves. But I kind of have a tendency to think that the citizen on their own property, there's many circumstances that we find that is the case.
You would just limit then to situations where the code authorizes the use of non-deadly force in defense of some property or premises, but not make it apply to situations in self-defense.
Well, certainly self-defense. Self-defense, if somebody's coming up with deadly force to you, yes. But what I'm saying is that if you're down here on the citizen's down here on the street and somebody threatens, they obviously can retreat. But I don't believe that the citizen has an obligation to retreat from his own property, his own premises. You know, I would hate to place it in a position just like Captain Baden was talking about. You know, it's all great and well to tell the 6'2" burglar to get out of your house. Well, I don't see
the code is redrafted, clearly says you may use deadly force in that situation.
Okay, but what about on your property?
If there's a trespass, it's drafted. If there's a trespass on property, the code simply says you may use non-deadly force. And the question, of course, is may you threaten deadly force? And again, the threat would have to be only with an intent to put the person in apprehension.
Right. And I think if that were set out, my
friend. I would say in defense of his property or residence, because very often what happens if you've got the nice shotgun property, you know, the apartment, you open up a door like that.
Larry, I checked it.
I don't. I guess I'm all by myself now. Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm just remembering some unpleasant experiences that I've had when I go up in the hills around Anchorage and people greet me with guns. Obviously, we'll be able to do it legally if we can still, but the point is that I was no threat to them. I was just inadvertently trespassing on their property, and I don't think it's necessary to give people that force and that ability to do that, unless there is a real threat to them.
It's important to note, though, that the code always speaks in terms of when to the extent reasonably necessary. So even though we're authorizing it, I think that you may have situations where it would not be reasonably necessary, and it would be an assault. It's kind of a little tricky little area there, but perhaps if you're a single person going up there, and you're obviously not armed, the idea of pulling a gun on you would not be when it could be extent reasonably necessary. So that concept is already brought in.
Yeah, the point is people do it now.
I'm missing out there. The situation I'm concerned about is that people do go hunting all over Alaska, and you just go a lot of areas in Alaska, especially like the southeast or something, you can just go hunting up right behind town. I used to do it all the time when I was a kid. I'd hunt right behind my house. You go up the mountain and then you come down, and of course you have to cross some property to get to the highway, and they're never marked. There's no such thing as a fence. People don't put signs. So you're walking across somebody's property, and you're just coming through the woods, and all of a sudden, you know, there it is. I mean, how do you know that the person has a right to be pointing a gun at you, and that they're not just some loony? And here I am, I'm coming down with my hunting rifle, and all of a sudden there's somebody, and it's happened to me several times. One time somebody shot my car, and you know, I mean, there are loonies running around, there's people who drink and have guns and what have you, but it really happens, and all of a sudden there's somebody pointing a gun at you, and he's saying you're trespassing his property, and all you know is it looks like any other woods you've been in all your life. The first thing I might get a little scared, and I just decide I've been shot at once too much. This guy isn't going to hit me. You know, I mean, you get confronted with a situation just like that, and I tell you, it is a little, you know, it gets your heart pumping. And I just don't know how you separate, because there are sometimes where, you know, somebody's on their property, and they're obviously snooping around or something, and you want to scare them off. But I don't like people pointing these guns at me when they shouldn't be. Okay, Ed's next.
Isn't there a reasonable word reasonable?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
I think probably in the circumstance you gave where man was just had no limit, you probably have something.
Is he going to have his property marked or something?
It does not require that. It simply says prevent a trespass. Although trespass, I believe, says if it's unimproved land and there's no fence or something, it's not a trespass.
You know, you gave me the story of where was the cop when I needed him? And there's not a policeman around to handle a lot of this stuff. And I know I've been in situations where, in fact, the lady's out there driving along And if you've got the kids in front of four or five of those brothers with chains wrapped around their neck, decide to turn her car over, and they're sitting there shaking her car and screaming and things. And she pulls out a gun and says, get back off of my car, you know, or I'll shoot you, or whatever threat she wants to protect herself. I don't see a nurse walking home at night or something got into a situation where she thought she might be in danger and tell a guy to leave me alone or something. I just think we don't want to get too close to depriving the citizen of his right to look after himself. If you're not bothering me, you won't be pointing guns back to the roof.
Okay. Bill?
It seems like we're trying to debate a philosophical point. We're using the absolute extremes. You gave one, Thankworth gave another one. And I don't know if that's the right one. We have to take the average case, and I think that's going to center around the protection of the individual's rights. Now, I'm about halfway thinking out loud. I don't know where this is going to lead, but the idea is to take the extreme worst case or best case we can think of. I think we have to look at the idea of, you know, what can I do to protect myself? It's a question. And I think we have to give the individual as much latitude as possible.
Okay, we're going to have to come up with some resolutions. We've gone around the table twice.
I'm going to make a motion. Recognizing that you're going to keep me here.
Well, you're not going to make our view. If somebody wants to make a motion,
I want to be drafting these things. You have to think about these unusual situations because they really do occur. And the police have to apply the motion. District attorneys really have to make decisions on whether or not they prosecute, and defense attorneys really have to make decisions on whether or not they have a criminal defense. So we're stuck with it. The screwiest hypothetical that could humanly happen is something we have to address with regard to every section of the code, and that's what makes it so difficult. And Mr. Chairman, my motion is that we do something along the line suggested here and limit it this way, that a person may use the threat of deadly force as long as he does not have the intent to use it in a situation where he is repelling an apparent trespass or threat that would otherwise not justify the use of deadly force. In supposedly when he's on his property, or go ahead and say in his residence. Because the problem is that you've got to cover the apartment dwelling.
Well,
we've
got deadly force, the burglary. Now, if you're talking about, if you're saying that when you're on your premises, you can threaten deadly force, well, that's another amendment. I don't know if you're saying
I'm not saying
okay.
That.
Okay. Then we've got the apartment dwelling for the burglary.
Okay, no, I'm talking about the situation where there's no crime been committed with the possible exception of a trespass. Or even there's not even a trespass. That is, suppose the driveway they drove. Suppose my house in Hallowed Acres. Okay, the alley is not my property. Yeah, yet it's like a driveway. It's right within 4 feet of my driveway. Suppose I've got four guys that drive up there, and they're getting out of the car, and they don't look like very nice fellows, and it's Saturday night, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, okay, we've got that covered under self-defense. And if you can reasonably believe it necessary, you may use non-deadly force. And if you think deadly force...
But the question is whether we include in the definition of non-deadly
force... Right, I understand that.
Fred, where are you covering? You're going to cover trespass?
You're covering everything, Fred. You're essentially, Fred's thing would be just to make the same thing that applied to peace officers apply to persons. Because I don't see...
No.
Fred, what are you covering? Trespass? What else?
I'm talking about areas where it is... at or near your residence or your property, and with the same reasonableness requirement that he indicated.
And fear for yourself.
Yeah. So it has to be reasonable.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, Fred.
You have a reasonable fear that there will be offense committed against yourself.
I understand, and I'm saying that it applies to everything. You don't have to make those distinctions because the two things you just gave.
It would not apply to you if you were walking down the street somewhere.
All right, the motion is... The motion is that a citizen would be able to, in situations where he can use non-deadly force, he would be able to threaten deadly force
without intention to use.
He would be able to threaten deadly force. In any situation. In other words, it's going to be the same as it is for police officers.
No, that's not my motion.
When can't he use it?
When he's walking down the street, thoroughly divorced from his own home or his own residence.
Okay.
It's very difficult, Fred, to do that into a statute. I mean, you know, people are complaining that we've got too many sections now. We're going to have another section that says use of force by person walking down the street, you know. I don't mean to be
I don't mean that. I would think that what you're drafting is something that addresses his behavior when he's at or near his own residence or his property.
Well, we don't have anything like that now. We have it when he's on his property, but we don't have when he's at or near.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Brown's amendment then would say that there is, you can, citizen can use deadly force when threatened deadly force when there is a trespass or when he is at or near his home.
That's not my motion because it's include all of the hardware in the drafting language, including that it has to be.
I propose it because of your reasons is at or near his home. I think that's
okay. I'll remove the near then.
I live in the Assembly Park. Is the street at or near my home? I don't know. Is it a parking lot?
I'll
park my car over here.
I'll remove the near, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you just make it at your residence?
Yeah. Well,
that's already covered. We've already got that. You already have the right to shoot him in your home.
We word that motion that gives
but
him
but that's
the
a trespass. If he's on your property, it's a trespass.
All right, Mr. Brown, clarify your motion.
Well, doesn't that what you're saying it's already covered, but doesn't that require a legal conclusion that it is a trespass?
It's based on a reasonable belief that someone is committing a trespass.
Can I have a reasonable belief that he's about to commit some crime other than a trespass?
Yes.
And then that would justify the use of what kind of...
Well, it depends what crime we're talking about. Burglary, arson, theft.
You mean whether or not I can use a gun to threaten deadly force depends upon my reading the statute to find out, I think I'm under threat of burglary rather than arson.
There's no distinction there. If it's an arson or a burglary, you can use it. If it's just taking of your property, it's non-dead. We'll get to those. Are unfortunately, I didn't think that those were a problem.
What's your motion, Fred?
Well, I'm trying to listen to your argument about why you think it's already covered.
Okay. All right. I'm going to state Fred's motion. Fred's motion is that where a citizen can use non-deadly force, he may threaten deadly force when there is a trespass, or when he is at or near his home.
I left out near.
Okay.
And then you're saying,
his home.
And then you made the argument that if I leave out near, that's already covered. If I can be persuaded you're right, I will withdraw the motion. Is that already covered?
I would make a motion to leave at his home. So that then the motion would read that a citizen can threaten to use deadly force when he can use non-deadly force when there is a trespass. So I would delete the second part of it.
Hasn't Barry already said that that's already in this new draft here?
At his home.
At his home, if it's a burglary, if he's afraid, if he's in self-defense, I'm not sure I understand what you mean at his home. You mean he has a guest over his house, and the guest pulls out a club, and he pulls out his gun. I mean, is that what the example is? Because if he pulls out his club, he probably thinks it's deadly force is being used against him. It's your motion is frankly confusing to me.
Okay, well, what about the example we heard in Fairbanks that we already alluded to once or twice here? And that is the situation.
Guy drives up, that's a trespass.
Okay, I'm on my property, I'm in my house. Suppose the driveway he drove up on is not on my property. Yet it's 6 feet from the
then it's based on self-defense.
As long as there's a reasonable belief that the current code drafts say that you can threaten or use that deadly force in that situation.
If you think deadly force can be used against you, you may use deadly force. If you think non-deadly force is going to be used against you, you may use non-deadly force.
Now, is that in the code or in this
That's
amendment?
That's both.
It's in both.
Yes.
Well, you're almost all the way to convincing me that you want this. What I'm talking about is already covered.
All right. Is there any discussion on my motion to delete the second part of the president's amendment? Okay. All right, I would delete the provision that says at his home.
But you would leave
trespassing. I think at his home, those situations are covered.
What happens if we take the trespass out?
Then it applies to everything. It covers
then you cover any situation.
Well, is that bad?
Well, we've discussed that.
That's the whole issue we've been discussing.
Well, if we give it to the peace officer, that guy any rights, the citizen doesn't have it. We give it to him, and the only argument is, of course, that he might have had some training to use the firearm. But listen. We have the same rights as
in my mind, it's not a right to point guns at people. And I think what we're telling peace officers they can use it because they're trained and we've hired them to do a job, which is to protect society. And I don't think it's a right to point guns any more than it's a right to drive a car. It's a privilege, you know, and at some point you draw the line. And to me, there's a limit to how much I want people pointing guns. I don't, when they're on their property, like I said, you can't retreat from your own property, and you kind of have, you know, think more of, you need to protect that citizen more, and therefore I want to give them right. But I don't want people walking downtown and then thinking they have the right to pull up their rifle at somebody because he was.
They don't.
I don't even want thinking that because.
Well, why would they think it?
Because the thing. Because the guy told them the name.
Unless the action is reasonable, they're still guilty of an assault, even if we have language as broad as Barry has on page 10 of the proposed amendment.
Some people think they have the right to do a lot of things.
Well, some people will be mistaken and believe that they are not committing a crime when they are, but that's true right now.
I just don't want to
Mr. Chairman, may I withdraw my motion to make another
Okay. Is there any discussion on my amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I asked to withdraw my motion, which means your amendment doesn't exist and it's my motion. Now I ask that I'd like to make a motion, but I think she's ahead of me.
I want to make a motion that we should not allow a private to agree to use the threat of deadly force. Period.
Unless deadly force would be just.
The motion is that the citizen would not be allowed to threaten deadly force. Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor of the motion, raise your right hand. All those opposed, same side. Mr. Carpenter.
I move the citizen should be permitted to use non-deadly threat of deadly force the way we apply the peace force.
Okay. Does everybody understand the motion?
Chairman, do I understand that if this motion were to pass, then basically we are approving the actual language that Mr. Stern has suggested on page 10 of his amendment?
I don't think it's necessary to look at the actual language.
It looks to me like we are.
Well, no, but
humor being very
yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. It's the actual language, but I think that's subject to.
Okay, well, you probably want to refine it.
Right.
Does everybody understand the motion, Mr. Lyons?
Mr. Greg gives an example.
Okay.
How far can they go?
Okay, you've got a guy walking across your property, and you come out, and you believe it's reasonably necessary in order to terminate his trespass on your property by pointing a gun at him. But again, you have to believe it's reasonably necessary. And I think that there are situations, for example, you have a youngster on your property. I don't believe it's reasonably necessary to go out with a gun, even though we're authorized, even though the effect of the amendment would say you could, under certain circumstances, go out there with a gun. It does not give the person to go out with a gun in all situations. If you got a 12-year-old kid, I would have to say that, except under extraordinary circumstances, if you go out with a gun and point it at him, it will not be justified. But if you have perhaps a 35-year-old man and you have some kind of fear that he may be coming to you.
A shorter explanation.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The shorter explanation, Dick, I
this is on your own property.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Well, and
not this amendment. Yeah. Mr. Chairman? Dick, at least the way I read it, if a jury thought you acted reasonably in threatening physical force with no intent to use it, then it wouldn't be an assault and you could do it. If they thought you were acting unreasonably, then it would still be an assault.
That would even apply to police officers.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
Okay, does everybody understand the amendment? All right, Lisa?
I think one of the things that concerns me about this is not, I understand what you said about you must have a reasonable belief and so on and so forth, but that's not the way life works. I mean, people come out and come down to people whether they have a reasonable belief or not. And the thing that concerns me about this is that we're putting into law the ability of people to drive people off their property without really any reasonable belief. The word will get out that, yeah, the law says you can drive people off. And it won't matter what it says in the law about you have to have a reasonable belief and all of that sort of stuff. It's perpetuating the situation that I've described what's happened to me and Terry's described what happened to him. But people putting guns on you when you really inadvertently are on their property and have no appearance of making any threat to them at all. It's just sort of, to my mind, confirming them and their belief that they should be able to do that. I don't think the circumstances are such are common enough that you're really going to need that to make it necessary to
Okay, I'm ready for the question. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, raise the right hand. All those opposed, same sign. Motion carried.
5-2. By the way, I don't tend to look at any language tables, so we'll get through the questions. The next issue is a very important one. And the question is, should deadly force... Okay, we're talking... Okay, we're talking now about how do we define deadly force. Now the issue is, and this was brought up by Chief Barkley, should deadly force be defined objectively or subjectively? Now in the code, the term is defined, in the code I'm talking about, what's in 661, it's defined as force that under the circumstances in which it is used is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. Under the alternative definition, which is in the amendment, oh, I'm sorry, it is not in the amendment, it's just what I'm throwing out now. Force which the person uses with the intent of causing, or which he knows to create a substantial risk of causing, death or serious physical injury. The example that was brought up to me would be like the idea of using mace or a baton. Under certain circumstances, it could be capable of causing death or serious physical injury, but it may in fact not be used with the intent of causing death or serious physical injury. I did some research on this, and most states that I looked at use the alternative definition based on the intent. The states that use the definition that we have in the code use the word readily capable, but the commission worked that one out. They did not want to have readily capable. They simply would want to have capable. So I see the issue is between the objective definition or the subjective one. I can understand why the alternative definition may not. I have no recommendation on it. I think the issue of the mace is the best one.
But it would be under one.
Yeah, I think that it could be under one. Well, I think that's one of the problems. With going to the second, the alternative definition. You should look at it objectively, which we had recommended.
Because then you always have to look, if you go to the second choice, you always have to try to figure out what the intent was, how it was used, whether he intended. So in other words,
you always have intent, but the subjective definition provides double intent.
Is the second one going to be a harder matter to prove?
Well, I would think so. You would have to show that the person acted with the intent of, causing that injury. Of course, now when you've got a situation where someone fires a gun or beats someone over the head senseless, you're going to find that he had the intent. The only example that I think that is in favor of why you would want the second one was because under some circumstances, mace could be... Okay. Well, I think that's covered, though, under the first one, frankly, because the first one does say under the circumstances in which it is used is capable. Well, if you hit someone with a knife, a stick, to just tap them, well, clearly that would not be deadly force. But yet if you bash them over the head 12 times, you're going to have deadly force.
That's not the situation, though, that is most common.
Okay.
Well, see, that's the problem that we find with this particular thing, because under the circumstances that you use a baton, you have every intent of incapacitating the individual. You know, that's the object of it, is to overcome what you are not able to overcome physically. And you have an intent to incapacitate, and under those circumstances, it certainly is capable of serious injury or death. In other words, the butt end of a nightstick and a diaphragm. You know, you're confronting a 6'2", 210 man that says, I ain't gonna go, you know, show me. Now, what's your alternatives? You pull a gun, well, obviously, yeah, we can use the threat, but you obviously can't use it, and all you might do is wind up eating it, you know? So you're in that position of having to use the nightstick. That's what you're trained for, and that's what you carry it for. And also, if you haul off and wrap a guy alongside of the neck or the head or something like that, yes, it is capable, but that obviously is not your intent. And you haul off in a fight situation to incapacitate an individual, you're trained to hit him over here on this big muscle so they can't raise their arms, incapacitate your arm. But that guy dodges him quite often. He'll get hit alongside the head. And so we feel that the intent has to be there, you know, because
Your intent is to incapacitate, and it is capable of. But you have no intent for it to be deadly, you know? And that's what you're confronted with in those types of situations. They just happen so fast. And
you like this definition
the alternative, the one that Hawaii's got, where you have to show where it has to be with intent. Because when you go into those situations, your intent is to incapacitate.
Yeah, but it's not.
And it certainly is capable of, under those circumstances. It is capable of. And that's what bothers us.
See, if you added the word readily to your, perhaps making it more of a requirement that it's true, it's anything is probably anything is capable of causing serious physical injury, depending on the circumstance. If you add the adjective readily, you're making it more of a stricter requirement. But again, when we considered that the same thing in terms of what a deadly weapon is, we said, well, is it readily capable or is it capable? And after a long discussion, we just simply said capable, and this carried over, of course, here.
Well, I think that Hawaii one is the one that would be the alternative. That is the alternative.
Yeah.
Well,
the alternative section. But Jim said, you know, you only just use one knife stick, you've got mace, you've got other things that people are going to use to do that. You can't disarm the police, you know, they can't do that to kill somebody. And, you know, you can hurt somebody. Okay, as long as you don't connect, you can show where a policeman has the intention. It's unnecessary that you hit somebody upside the head with blood, you know, or something else, and that's something else, but that's why. And we wouldn't want to support that, but that's why it makes it hard to put the police officer. I mean, it's so easy for us to sit around this table, but I've been out there, and I know you get four or five of those guys only at one time, and you're swinging a club, and then you find out you didn't have any intent to kill him, but one or two of them ended up with hurt a little worse than you thought they would. But at the time, and in that split second, when you're out there by yourself, you get a tent, you need some protection in there, but you're going to have to get out of there the best way you can.
Lisa. Lisa.
I don't think I want to ask a question.
Do you want to ask a private?
No.
Larry.
I move the alternative definition.
Questions? Comments? All those in favor of the alternative definition, raise your right hand. All those opposed?
Okay.
The motion fails.
Motion passes. There's something else I want to bring up just on this subsection too. In Hawaii, which I left out of the draft, they specifically provided that intentionally firing a firearm in the direction of another person or in the direction which another person is believed to be constitutes deadly force. I think considering we have the intent requirement, I would like to add that in. In other words, specifically provide when you fire a firearm in the direction of another person or in the direction where he's believed to be, that is deadly force. So limit any, you know, when you've got a situation where someone's shot, pulls a trigger, that's deadly force.
Well, then, Barry, you're going to prompt me. Go ahead and ask the question I was going to ask before. What, when we're talking about deadly force, what circumstances are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about, if we get to that number three, but I guess self-defense, for example, when you think deadly force is going to be used against you. The problem, of course, is now we've defined deadly force, it's going to require me to redraft this, but say you believe that you're threatened with serious physical injury, then the question is, can you use deadly force?
Okay, now let me follow that up, Rich. If we use the alternative definition, if we allow police officers and citizens to threaten to use deadly force, we're allowing them to threaten to use force which the person uses with the intent of causing or which he knows to create a substantial risk of causing death and so on. In other words, he's threatening to use something that he is going to use with the intent of or create a substantial risk of. That doesn't seem to drive me.
Right, I think I've got it. You mean the idea of threatening?
How can you threaten to use something but then the use of it involves an intent?
I think it can. I'm a good friend to blow.
I
pull up my gun. I say, I'm gonna blow your head off,
right.
And you can prove that, you know, he in fact intended to blow the guy's head off.
Yeah, but that's not just threatening. It's meaning.
It's what?
It's blow your head off if we agree everybody should be able to threaten, right?
Yeah.
But if the definition of deadly force means carries an intent
yeah.
of causing this injury or death, then you're threatening something that you intend to carry out.
I do. I have to think about it. I don't see any problem.
Circumstances.
Larry? I see what Lisa sees, but I don't see it that way. She sees what we just got through doing and what we did before that as being incompatible. But if you follow the thread of what she's saying through, I don't think it means that. I think where you've arrived is where you should arrive.
Well, you redefined non-deadly force to include the threat of deadly force. And deadly force carries the intent of causing death or serious physical injury.
But it doesn't add to what we did the time before that intent. It doesn't automatically place an access point in intent.
I've got it down and draft it. No, I've got to sit down and regret these things just to ensure that it becomes clear. But I don't.
I think Lisa is correct when you, at least in your proposed definition of threat of deadly force.
The one the committee just adopted.
Right, you said with no intent to use the deadly force, and then you're coming back and saying, by defining deadly force, you're saying intends to use it. There's a problem there. Might be.
Larry? No. Because, although in what we just, the action we just took, the intent is there. If it's superimposed on the first one, which was the non-deadly force, including the threatening deadly force, because there's no intent there, it cancels it.
Right.
It doesn't carry over. It can't carry over.
I think I've really got to sit down and write this all out.
Deadly force means intent, right? But we're allowing an exception we're making an exception of non-deadly force, even though the definition of deadly force is with intent. We're allowing an exception for non-deadly force to include the threat of deadly force when it's to create apprehension. So we're canceling the intent for that one exception, which we just made. So
the two
are compatible. Yes?
I've got to sit down with it. I don't think they are, but I've got to sit down with it. Work that out. I don't think they are. I don't. Should be dead. How about that additional language, though, about discharging a firearm in the direction is, in fact, deadly force?
Well, give us an example of what you said.
Well, I think it's intentionally firing a firearm in the direction of another person or the direction which another person is believed to constitute deadly force. It's because I think that we're making it difficult to prove what deadly force is now since we added the intent requirement. And I think that by saying once you press the firearm at a direction where a person is believed to be, that is deadly force. We've shown your intent. Someone's in the woods and you say, get out of here, you SOB, and you shoot at them, that's deadly force.
Let them shoot up in the air.
Well, it's not covered by the language. Intentionally firing a firearm at the direction of another person or in the direction which another person is believed to be constitutes deadly force. Unless he's in a parachute, it could probably be covered. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, may I suggest that you pass over this now? I'm very concerned. I think that's the question that I raised. Maybe the answer to that might make a difference.
I don't think that this one doesn't actually, the firearm. I mean, if we're going to stay with the intent which you just voted on, I think it's a necessary, refinement of it. But
I'm thinking if you have problems with drafting it with the intent and the threatened of deadly force in other circumstances and so on, maybe we'd like to retreat.
Chip, you see that there is a problem if there is.
Of course,
okay. Well,
I think the best way to handle it is to take the idea of threat out of the definition of force and say in the substantive provisions when you may threaten to do things, and then you don't have the problem of dragging in the concept of threat every time you say force.
I agree with you there, but the question is, well, let's forget about the question.
That sounds like
what you wanted to do based on what we decided on today, you wanted to add that section of the highway code.
Yeah, about pointing the firearm you know, I mean, I'm sorry, discharging a firearm in the direction of that person is deadly force.
Well, let me, I'll move that amendment. You know, we might as well get done. If we have to go back, it wouldn't make that much difference.
Well, yeah, I'll vote against the amendment because I think, you know, I'd rather know, be absolutely clear on what we're talking about in these other areas before.
Well,
but judging on my score for today, I'll probably be in
the majority. If I can comment on my reason I'm putting the motion in, and the instance is going on with this, I see no objection to that. And if we find out later that it's inconsistent, we won't argue about whether that what we've done so far is inconsistent. It wouldn't change the fact that we're going to need this.
Yeah, I can see that.
That is consistent with what
we just did. It's very consistent.
I agree with what we just did.
Right.
Definitely.
If you did what we just did, and you voted against it, right.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll keep my motion in.
Any comments on the motion?
Ready for the question? Is anybody awake?
All those in favor, raise your right hand. Opposed.
Okay. The next answer, the next question is three, and that is one of the most important. No, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman? All right. Before we go on to three, I, regardless of which way Barry comes down, after he thinks about it, I think that what Chief Barclay wanted in the alternative definition, and what the full committee here wanted in the first question on non-deadly force happening, I think both can be accomplished. And I'd encourage you, whatever you come back with, if you come back with something in addition to whatever else you
do. I think I understand. I think, though, that Jim's point is dealing with friends. This is, I consider three probably one of the most important decisions you're going to make. The question is, when can you use deadly force in making an arrest? Now, the House Bill 661 says, when the peace officer reasonably believes the person he's attempting to arrest has committed or attempted to commit a felony. I'm sorry.
Is that key? Maybe go to some of the lighter questions.
Well, I wish I could say that any of these are very lighter. Well, they kind of follow from it, Bill. Okay, let's turn to question six, which is, I think, incorrectly labeled sense. This is a correctional facility escapes. Under the code, this is, by the way, it's on page 7 of your draft. I think you probably could look at the language. It's a 7 of the amendment. I'm sorry, it's 7 of the amendment. As we drafted this, we're saying that in preventing an escape from a correctional facility, the guard or peace officer may use deadly force when necessary to prevent the escape. Excuse me. First of all, I'd like it to be noted that correctional facility should be defined in the general definition section. Currently, it's only defined in the escape section, but should be defined in general definition. But secondly, I'm sure if you were at the public hearings, you heard one of the defense attorneys say that this provision was too broad, that if you have an escapee by a person that is a misdemeanant or has committed a nonviolent felony, you shouldn't be allowed to use deadly force under any circumstances. Now, if you want to limit this section, which is section 210, you may want to add, may use deadly force upon another person when to the extent reasonably necessary to prevent the escape from a prisoner from a correctional facility, unless he knows that the person has committed a, quote, nonviolent felony, and then we'll have to define what a nonviolent felony is. But if someone's escaping from a correctional facility and you know he's a misdemeanant, you know affirmatively that he's a misdemeanant, that would say you can't allow him to use deadly force. And again, you would have to prove that a person knew. It doesn't matter what it turns out, you would have to prove that person, the correctional facility guard, knew the category of the person. If he didn't know, he could use deadly force.
And I don't know, I have some problem. I realize the example the defense attorney showed the other day about the drunk standing there being put, walked off and somebody shoots him in the back or something. And I didn't see that is what they were, this thing was really getting at. What would you do in the event, forget about the misdemeanor business, but a lot of our, or even more and more, guards are both female and there's no size limitation, guards with say to a guy there, and the guy's committed misdemeanor, so he leaves my side. And he says, I think I'll leave. And he starts walking up. He's going down the street. What conditions do we have? What can that person do to stop?
Now, this is cover here. Use of non-deadly. I mean, use right now, I could shoot him. We just, you know.
Yeah, but what would, answer my question, if I decided to walk out of an institution, yeah. What can that man or woman do about it? Is there, are they just say, well, it's a misdemeanor?
Under existing law, you could only use deadly force if it was a...
Or the amount of force necessary or something.
You can only use deadly force under existing law if the person committed a felony. Under the code, it's drafted, you could only use... you can use deadly force no matter what the person's committed. Under the suggested amendment, it was based upon your knowledge.
Well, I'm just worried about leaving the door open there where these people that are supposed to hold a station jail just have a real problem if the guy just decided to leave. I think I'll go on home. Now, is the person there supposed to hit him over the head with a club with intent to do one?
Well, we just defined that as deadly force, if it was intended.
What can they do if we ride ourselves and guard people got out of business in English?
Number one, Lisa.
You know, it seems to me I've heard from time to time complaints from police that we're constantly tying their hands by various ways, and this seems to be a classic. I mean, you can't shoot the guy until you know exactly what offense he committed. He has to know that it wasn't.
It's the reverse.
But still, it's the same. When you're in a hurry,
if he's in a hurry, then he doesn't know, and then he can use deadly force. Yeah, but if he says, "Here's Joe Blow,"
he has to figure out in his mind whether he knows or not before he shoots.
And no one wants the amendments. I mean, no one brought it up here. It was just brought up by the defense attorney. I just brought it up because people asked the crazy things up.
Larry, I don't want the amendment either because you know I'm the guardian. I could think of Terry and said it was Fred. And the idea should be to keep them all in as long as they're supposed to be in.
And you had your hand up a moment ago.
Well, I was wondering, are we still on this statement of issues or are we going through the language of the draft?
We're on statement of issues number six.
Oh, excuse me.
We skipped to some of the less substantive points. Ed.
Well, to answer some of the questions, maybe to answer my own question, isn't there the word reasonable in there? You know, I can see where if you say a reasonable force, now what will shooting a drunk if he's walking off the back is not reasonable. But somewhere in there, it seems to me we have to put reasonable force is necessary to hold him in against
him. I don't think you need to. No one has made the amendment, and I assume I'll move on.
All right, good.
I'm told to bring up the amendment.
Yeah, it says he reasonably believes it necessary.
Yes, okay. Secondly, let's move to seven. This is the duty of retreat. If you turn to the draft, and you turn to page. If you go to the amendment, every time I tell you to turn to the draft, I'm talking about the amendment. Okay. You turn to page, bottom of page two. Okay, bottom page two says, the person may not use deadly force if he knows that he can with complete safety add to himself and others, avoid the necessity of doing so by retreating, except there is no duty to retreat if the person is in his dwelling and not the initial aggressor. Now, at the Fairbanks hearing, it was suggested that we expand at the premises. It was suggested also during our discussion that we expand the premises.
On the premises? Is that what you
mean? On his premises, which obviously would include dwelling, would also include the
automobile. 168?
Yes, that's correct. It would consider his property.
How about
premises would, that's an interesting point. It would not cover, it would not cover automobile. Premises is real property, including a building. If it was used as a dwelling, yes. If it was just used as a, I understand what you're bringing up, and I could, expand that. But first, maybe you consider premises, and then you give me another change, I can take care of it. Right now, it's
a
dwelling.
It seems to me a home is the same as a boat, as a car, as a motorcycle.
Propelled vehicle we're talking about. Well, you're not going
to
have
We don't have to remember language. Yeah. Just trying to get the concept out. But it seems to me that that's essentially all the same.
Okay.
And everybody leap to agree at once. We'll just keep it.
Where are you, Jack?
On page three of the amendment. No, top of the page in his dwelling, the second one.
Okay.
if no one brings it up, if no one suggested it here, I mean, specifically, it was brought up in public hearings.
I think I agree with what was brought up in the public hearing, so I'll move the amendment to use the word premises in place of dwelling.
Yeah, premises would be brought up to include as well. Well, it's line two.
It's line two, page three. Starts at the bottom of page two.
Speaking to the amendment, it would seem to me that we could let's say that it's pretty hard to retreat from the premise. It seems to me that this would apply
Larry, I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Well, I'm saying that if I'm on the street, maybe I can retreat. But let me give you an example. Last summer...
The whole point of this section is you do not have any duty to retreat if you adopt your amendment on your premises and so on. This relieves you of the duty to retreat.
That's right. I want to be relieved of the duty to retreat while I'm on my premises rather than just in my dwelling. Right? There was a local hood who had busted a whole bunch of times, and I was with a friend in my backyard this summer, and my wife and his wife were inside the house, and this guy came onto our property, which is fenced in. He came onto our property through a back gate. He said he needed to use the phone. He needed help. He'd been injured. Well, from my experience, I knew this guy, there's been any injury done, he's been doing it. Got a bit of his own back, and he had a gun, and I didn't want him to go in the house. And imagine the situation of having family in the house and being out, and it's not a case of you wanting to retreat to the dwelling. Is an invitation for the trespasser to come to the dwelling, right? In a very practical sense, if he's intent on reaching a showdown someplace, going into your house brings the action to the door, and I don't want to bring the action to the door. To protect my family, I don't want to retreat from my barbecue. I shouldn't have to, I wouldn't think. Where are we being unfair to anyone by having premises?
Yeah.
Rather than dwelling.
I'll support your motion to finish the story later.
Okay. You know the guy.
Property is the broadest example. Yeah, and property includes real property. And property obviously includes dwellings, buildings,
hotels.
I'll withdraw my amendment. You offer one.
Did mine speak to what you were talking about?
Yes, in or on his property.
In or on his property, striking his dwelling, and the rest remains in the documentation address.
And I just suggested some language be added that would make it clear that it would not have to be the owner of the property, that it could be an occupier or renter or something like that.
That's a good point. I assume we mean that. Like, in other words, it may not be his property he's renting, but we're intending to be probably owned or leased or rented by him, something to that effect.
Right.
Yes.
What if I said in or on?
I can come up with the language as long as you agree on the, that that's what you mean.
Yeah, under
I'll come up with something.
Well, we want under his control, and maybe it'll come with the door. But
I drive a car a lot, but I've never been under control.
Okay, everybody know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Larry? Clear? And a motion? Property? And we're going to have a new language that somehow relates, not necessarily ownership.
Yeah.
Okay.
All in favor of the amendment, raise your right
hand. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess we'll...
Now, can we move this whole amendment?
No. Yeah, you're not going to move this amendment anyway. we're adjourned.
House Judiciary Committee meeting February 8th, 1978, adjourned 4:57 p.m.
Tickets are falling, non-deadly force, including a threat of deadly force. And every time we allow a person to use non-deadly force, we allow the threat of deadly force. And we have a general provision that says whenever the provision in this code allows the use of deadly force, non-deadly force, it includes the slight threat of deadly force.
I
don't get
one to put in there.
Our
comments
were had mentioned criminals
on the air. I think it's also knocking down the force. But what about this? How does that present
problems? What happened to him? He beat a guy up out of the airport somewhere. About a month after that, he ended up slamming or getting on something. I don't even remember.